for having us.
Absolutely. So we'll continue with item five, and you have the floor.
Excellent.
If you want to start with the introduction and then go into your presentation.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for the business for our current manager for you, and we appreciate it. For time, I know you might be running behind. We can limit the time if you'd like, or whatever is best for you.
Excuse me. Can we do just a quick housekeeping thing down here before
Sure.
we get started?
So, as we tell everyone, obviously this is a public meeting and this is a public document.
Yes.
And are you okay with that?
Yes.
Okay,
absolutely.
Great.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Did you, is there anyone who doesn't have a copy? Because we have extra copies if anybody needs any.
Yeah, for this one, we're using this one, number six.
Yeah.
Yes. It looks like everyone has.
Okay, and timing?
I think we're doing okay on
time. Okay, perfect. So we plan on about 30 minutes, just a presentation with questions. So feel free to jump in at any point in time. We don't want to be scheduling time for questions at the end, so jump in. I'm going to say apologies right now because I'm going to use some jargon that you probably don't understand, so please stop me and say, what does that mean? Because I tend to do that, and we'll tend to do that. My name is Ben Lazarus. I work on institutional relationships with Parametric in the West Coast. I know a lot of you from seeing you at different spots at Sackers or Calipers or different things like that. This is Jay Strohmeyer. He's a managing director at Parametric. He's been with the firm for many years, a couple different stints, and he runs this particular strategy. So with that, I will just kind of tell you what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about this particular strategy, which we call defensive equity, which is a custom strategy for your particular risk diversifying portfolio. We think it really meshes well with what you have today and what you plan to grow with this particular allocation. I'll talk just briefly about the firm since you pretty much know us for the most part. I'll turn it then over to Jay. Jay will talk about how it's constructed, what your objectives are, how this meets your objectives. He'll talk about returns and what to expect, because we want you to know exactly how this is going to perform in different markets. That's very important. Then I'll come back in on fees, and we'll wrap it all up. With that, any questions before we go after it? All right, let's skip out to page four. This is just a brief snapshot timeline of Parametric. I'll just let you know, as an organization, we are very rules-based, very much not a fundamental active manager or a stock picker. We like to have consistent results that are with predictive outcomes. And that's what we think is important in this type of structure, because you don't want somebody second guessing what the market is going to give you in this particular space. It's very much a rules-based approach, and you have to have risk controls. And everything we do at Parametric is very risk controlled. We are very focused in that area. So this is supposed to be risk diversifying. You don't want this to start blowing up at the time when you need it to do what it's supposed to do, which is to provide that anchor to windward, which we've really built it to do. It's very customized. Everything we do is very customized. So you'll see that there's a lot of varietals in this type of program, but we've constructed one that we think is very much in line with what your needs are.
Yeah, the product you're showing, I know it says 2011 you launched your first VRP strategy, but when we're looking at today, that started
at that particular. Now, so what we are showing for you today is a combination of that philosophy with a different type of collateral, and Jay's going to get into that, a very, very protected collateral. Most of our clients use a beta that or have equities in that collateral. We're not contemplating that for this particular mandate, but we'll talk through that. But the philosophy, yes, started in 2011. We've been trading options since the 80s, so we're very familiar with these markets in all sorts of different environments. I'll flip out to page six just to show, again, this is the franchise. This is the VRP franchise. We have about $230 billion in assets under management. We're talking about $17.6 billion in this franchise. Jay's going to talk about why there's different varietals, why yours is a little bit different, and it's really about your objectives. This is a unique risk-return profile, and we want to put it to a way that can maximize what you need it for. We don't want this to be something that's off the shelf, because off-the-shelf is not exactly what you need. You have specific concerns, and we want to address them. We have about 33 public clients that use this type of approach. Not exactly how you're looking at it, but very similar. And really, what they're doing is a little more risky than what we're proposing for you. Again, they're tying a lot more growth into this volatility risk premium, which Jay's going to get into. So the management team is on page 7. These people spend a majority of their time in this particular strategy. Obviously, you'll see Jay's picture there. And I guess with that, I will turn it over to him unless there's any more questions about the firm and the team.
All right. Great. If you flip out to page 10, let's talk a little about why this volatility risk premium exists in the first place. It's a phenomenon that's been heavily researched with pieces written back to the 1970s, well documented. And I think most of us agree that there are kind of three key factors that cause this to this phenomenon to happen and to persist over time. The first one is economic factors, essentially options or financial insurance contracts. And insurance is not free. And on the surface, for an insurance underwriter, the risk return structure doesn't look real attractive. So we'll talk about that. That, of course, is part of the reason it turns out to be attractive. Secondly, and closely related, behavioral bias, risk aversion. People hate to lose money, and so it causes them to pay more for insurance than it's truly worth. And then finally, structural factors, supply and demand imbalances. Most investors have portfolios that are heavily weighted towards equities, and the risk is largely driven by equity risk. And so there's always more people looking, natural buyers of insurance than sellers of insurance, and so that works to our advantage. Page 11, at the core, as I mentioned, options are financial instruments, financial insurance instruments, and I think you'll recognize some of the similarities to other forms of insurance. So option buyers pay premiums. That's the most that they can risk, and so it will remind you of the check that we all send each year to State Farm or Allstate for things like homeowners policies. Send them a check for $5,000, they rarely send it back. And if the house burns down, they're on the hook for writing a check for $500,000. Well, out here, $2 million. And where I live, $500,000. And so that's what I'm talking about. This looks unattractive on the surface. They can make a little, the premium, they can lose a lot, right? So underwriters are facing a much less defined risk scheme, or certainly a much larger risk, and that's why this exists. So insurance business has a proven long-term track record of being profitable for insurance sellers, insurance underwriters. That's the way it works. And in fact, when we all write our check to Allstate or Aetna or State Farm, we don't actually expect them to send the check back with a 5 or 6% coupon. We expect they're going to keep it. They're the ones that have capital at risk, and we're going to turn around and we're going to write them another check, and they probably won't send that one back either. So that's why this exists. And so if you turn to page 12, how do we know for sure that it's there? This is about the best way to see it. And this is daily data back to 1990. And you can think of this chart as a relative valuation chart for options, for puts and calls on the S&P 500, much like a PE chart is a valuation chart for a stock picking manager, relative valuation for options. And so the punchline here is that when these bars are positive, options are trading somewhat rich relative to their fair theoretical or actuarial value. If we all knew what was going to happen in the future with perfect foresight, this wouldn't happen. But, of course, none of us do. When the bars are negative, and you see occasionally that happens, it turns out that options were trading cheap relative to fair valuation. And so we look at this and we see 85% of the time options are trading with the wind at our back. They've got this built-in buffer. And this is not an inefficiency. This comes back to the nature of the insurance transaction. The insurance underwriter can make a little, can lose a lot. Nobody's going to enter into that game and insure things unless they can get pricing and probabilities stacked in their favor. 85% odds are pretty compelling. I mean, you go play at in the casinos in Las Vegas at blackjack, the odds are 52, 48, something like that, and you can nudge them a little closer to your side if you follow, if you play by the rules. But I can sit down and I can get four or five blackjacks in a row, But if they can keep me there for 100 hands, it's really tough to overcome the odds. 85%, that's stacked heavily in our favor. That's why we want to be in it. That's why we want to avoid market timing. If we try and improve the odds from 85%, we're likely to push them more to 75, and that's not exactly constructive. So that's why we do what we do.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Just staying with the gaming analogy, do you see your strategy in the role of the house? Or as a bookmaker?
We are the house.
You're the house.
We are the house, yeah.
On the strip.
That's
yeah, that's even better.
Bookmaker, I'm not sure that I want that on record. You know? But yeah, we see ourselves in the role of the house as the underwriter. Yeah, and the odds are stacked in our favor.
All right, thank you.
But to the extent of creating or manipulating the market, you don't see yourself in that space. It's more of monitoring and participating in the market, not making the market.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. We're price takers, but we're there as a provider of insurance. We can't set the price. The price is what it is. It gets worked out on the trading floor.
Exactly.
And manipulation is a word that I do not understand, and I do not want to understand. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, what are your challenges? Page 14. We understand that you're looking for things in this risk diversifying portfolio that have low to negative correlation with the growth assets, that can be reasonably relied on to deliver positive returns over most environments, at least normal environments, and maintain a very high degree of liquidity. We think that this strategy can deliver on all three of those characteristics. So what are we going to talk about doing? We call it DEO, Defensive Equity Overlay, Option Overlay. And with this approach, we're going to hold Treasury bills, full faith and credit U.S. Treasury bills, and we're going to overlay put and call options on top of that, and we'll look at a specific example. As Ben mentioned, it's very customizable. You can dial this thing up or dial it down, and a lot of times I like to describe it as you pull into the Shell station and they've got gas that's 87 octane, might even have 85 with some ethanol built in, and you can go up to 87, 89, 91, and sometimes you even see 93. We can dial this up and dial this down based on what people are trying to achieve. It's very low cost, and the objective here is T-bills plus 4 to 6 over a full market cycle. I'm not exactly certain what a full market cycle is. It's always a tough thing to define, but I know it includes bull markets, bear markets, and sideways markets. And I know what we've been in for a long time has been a one-way bull market. So how do we build the portfolio? That's the topic of page 15. We try to keep it very simple. This portfolio has three different types of securities. And so the example we provide here, we're going to assume $100 million capital commitment to kind of walk through the way that the portfolio would build. And we're going to put the $100 million right into U.S. Treasuries. The key thing there is that those U.S. Treasuries can have no more than 1 year remaining until maturity. So it might be a Treasury bill, it might be an old 10-year note that was issued 9 years ago and there's 1 year left, but what we don't want in there is a bunch of interest rate risk that could hurt you if rates go up. We actually want something that's going to help you when interest rates go up, and so that's what short-term Treasuries do. So we've got zero beta, no equity exposure there. Next thing we're going to do, we know that you have several billion dollars in equity, large cap, small cap, international, emerging, etc. We are going to economically commit to sell $100 million of your equity exposure if the market were to rally 3 to 4% over the next 4 weeks. We're going to do that by selling a call option on the S&P to a speculator, somebody who wants to own the market, but they only want to own it if it has gone up a lot. They'd be willing to buy upside financial insurance from us through a call option. Simultaneously, we are going to commit. We know you're sitting on high-quality liquid cash and fixed income securities, short-term government credit, things like that. We're going to commit that if the market were to sell off by 4 to 5% over the next 1 month, we would be willing to step up and buy equities. I have never run into anybody who doesn't believe buying low and selling high isn't a smart thing to do. That's kind of one of the main rules in this business: buy low, sell high. Everybody talks about it. It's hard to do when markets are volatile, right?
this discipline, this rules-based approach, forces us to commit to sell into a rally, buy into a dip. So we're essentially selling lottery tickets to speculators. We're on the upside. We're selling downside protection to nervous investors by selling them put options. And that activity, as a pair, we put those two trades onto one ticket. They're market neutral as a pair. And each of those insurance policies has an 80% statistical probability of expiring what we call out of the money or with no claims. If you're selling insurance, you don't want to have claims on every policy, right? Because you know all you can keep is the premium. So you're hoping you sell the policy, there are no claims, you've maximized the profits from that policy. So we set that likelihood of no claims on these policies at 80%. And essentially what that means is that over time, when you get it into more volatile markets, it means you're going to sell policies with bigger deductibles and with bigger premiums. And so there's a way that we essentially have built in an auto recalibration process so that we can keep these options very much in sync with what's going on in the market.
Jay, the two things that you do to pick 80% is the amount of time that the option it will run, and the second is the strike price relative to current market value.
Right.
And how do you do that?
So how we do that, so the options have 4 weeks to expiration, so they're very short-term policies. The put and the call both expire at the same time, right? Same day, same time. So we use the Black-Scholes pricing model. It's not perfect, but it's the best option pricing model out there. And there's a statistic within the Black-Scholes pricing model that you can extract from the model that tells you what the likelihood of that option has of having a claim or expiring worthless. And so that's what we're using. We're just using the common market pricing model. Important thing for you, it's not our model. It's not my opinion. It's not Ben's opinion or anybody else. We have opinions. We just don't act on our opinions with your money. We keep it very straightforward and rules-based. So that's how we select it.
And these rules have been in effect since 2011, since we started this program. So this is we're not making up these rules for your particular strategy. We're creating the product for your particular needs with T-bills as the collateral in the program.
A little bit more on the options, because that's important. So we talked about the probabilities being stacked in our favor. 85% of the time, these options, these financial policies are trading kind of rich at bigger prices. And so if the odds are stacked in our favor, like an insurance company, you don't want to just insure that building right across the street, because you might get unlucky. That might be the building that burns down. But if you insure 100 buildings, you're going to get the law of large numbers working in your favor. So we break the options up into 12 tranches. Each tranche has a put and a call. And so every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we have a put and a call that each represent around 4 to 4.5% of our total exposure expires, and they're rolled out another 4 weeks. These things are cash settled, so if there's a claim, we write a check. We don't actually go through the delivery process. We're not actually going to trade the physical stocks. We're not actually going to sell the stocks if the market went up. We're not actually going to buy them. We're just going to settle it, much like if your house burns down, State Farm doesn't send a carpentry crew out, they send you a check. They cash settle it, and you get to go buy find your own builder. And so that activity of selling these financial insurance policies over the long terms, we expect to generate 4 to 6% per year in profits.
On that point, Jay, can you share with us, if you're able to, the closest analogous custom plan you have for a public fund client, and share the return history? I understand that this is a one-off and all that, but sure. There's something analogous you can share? I think it would be helpful.
Yeah, we've got, as I mentioned, there's lots of ways to, a lot of different octanes that you can have. So we have clients who, if you look at the chart on page 15, a lot of our clients, we've got like around 300 clients, and across there are probably 12 or 14 or 15 different variants. We've got some that work in the international space, so global defensive equity. others domestic. We've got some that are more aggressive, some that are less aggressive. But a lot of our clients, instead of having $100 million in T-bills, in an example like this, they have $50 million in the S&P 500 and $50 million in T-bills because they want some beta. You don't want beta. You got enough beta. So in those mandates, if $100 million is invested, we put $50 million into T-bills, $50 million into equities, and then we sell calls against the equity, and we sell puts against the Treasury bills. So in the most draconian environment, the market goes to zero. Well, half the portfolio was in stock, so that's down 50%, and we also sold puts on $50 million. So we've lost essentially all that money. You lose all your money. It's like if the market goes to zero, you lose all your money. Now, for you don't want... You don't want the beta in there. So we're going to hold $100 million in Treasury bills, but we can actually hold $100 million in short puts and $100 million in short calls because they are opposite exposures. And at any particular expiration, if we get hurt on one side, we made money on the other side. Just think about, you know, we've got a put and a call out there. We have one today, a put that expires today and a call that expires today. If the market went through the strike price of the put, we have a liability. But since we hold these things at expiration, we have a profit on the call. So in that case, so we have some clients who say, look, I don't want, you know, like Cicera, I don't want that beta exposure in there. I just want the options. And so we could either on a $100 million mandate, we've got a lot of them that say, well, just do like you would in the normal defensive equity strategy. If it's a $100 million mandate, sell 50 calls, sell 50 puts.
Right.
But there, in the most draconian situation, market goes to zero, we only lose, you know, $45 to $50 million. So we're not really fully deploying that capital. We've got a number of clients that do that, and we've got some clients that, and I'm trying to get fully to your question. We have clients that run underdeployed, more like 50% deployed. We have clients that run 100%, and we've got some that run 700 or 800%. Some that actually run on a lot of leverage. So it really does run the gamut. What we're talking about for you is no leverage, just fully deploying.
Right. So what I'm getting at is, though, the premium, the end game here is to try to get 4 to 6%, right?
Yes, exactly.
So are you achieving that for someone you can describe for me as your closest analogous client?
Yeah. So over the last 6 years, we've achieved around would be 250 basis points or so annualized over the last 6 years. On the clients that are doing half of the exposure that are underdeployed, so that would translate to 5% for a portfolio like yours. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Now that's kind of dead center in the 4 to 6 range. I actually think that we can probably expect we'll do a little bit better than that 4 to 6 over Treasuries over the long term. But you know, we do try to underpromise and overdeliver is always, you know, a better approach than overpromise and underdeliver.
Agreed.
Did that address your
question?
Yes.
Question? Yeah. I just wanted to get a sense. I mean, this is not exactly an easy subject to digest and understand.
Yeah.
For those of us who don't do this for our day job.
Yep.
So, in terms of trying to grasp the concept, you know, we're going to do the best we can to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But the real question is, at the end of the day, what's your experience with achieving the premium that we think we're buying? That's what it gets down to for us, I think.
Yep, absolutely.
Is 4 to 6 over Treasuries equivalent to 5+ to 7 on a gross basis?
Yeah, so 4 to 6 over Treasuries. So like right now, believe it or not, a one-year Treasury that I looked this morning is yielding about 2.06%. You know, and I never thought I could get excited about that, but I was really excited. Because for a long time, I've been investing in Treasuries about 0.1% or even less. So let's just say the one-year Treasury stay at 2% for the next 5 to 10 years. If we achieve our objectives here, let's just say, let's go right in the middle, 5% over Treasuries, we would be 7% essentially.
7 has a ring in this group.
Okay.
That's our assumption, right?
Well said.
Okay. Sounds familiar.
Well said.
I thought that was totally inside baseball, but now I know your secret. Yeah, so that's what we would be talking about. And it does appear that rates are, you know, likely to continue moving higher. That's just good. It means we're earning more on the collateral here.
What would you expect the return to be after fees? So 4 to 6%.
So the fees are 42 basis points. So that would be, 5.5 or 3.5 to
3.6 to 5.6.
Yeah, something like that.
So you just knock around 40. What did you say? 42 basis
42,
points.
42. Yeah, 42 on the $200 million. If you grow higher, it actually goes down. But we're contemplating $200 million in this particular mandate.
So the 4 to 6 would be like you said, 3.5.
To 3.5. Yeah. 3.5 to 5.5 net of fees.
Okay.
Yes. Yep.
Well, Scott Mitch, this is like all new to us, especially to me. It's probably the area I know the least most about. Are you predicting the market then? Is that what you're doing?
I mean, no.
You're making these puts and calls, but you're basing on the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, I mean, somebody sitting there saying, I think it's going to go up, I think it's going to go down. You're making these
puts. No. In fact, we are like the anti-predictors. We don't predict anything. If you flip out maybe quickly to page 31... if you think about what we're doing here, we're selling calls that are, like I said, we're going to kind of pre-commit to selling 100 million of your equity if the market rallies 3.5 to 4, and we're going to pre-commit to buy equity if it falls 4 to 5. We call these the range of indifference. So the blue line, the top blue line on the page 31. Is the level at which, and of course, the bottom blue line are the puts that we're selling to nervous investors. Top blue line, the calls we're selling to speculators. The gray bars are the monthly S&P 500 price change. So all we're trying to do, Mr. Rodriguez, is we're making a, we're saying we think there's a really good high likelihood that the market's going to stay within this band. Okay. Over the next 4 weeks, because there are these short-term policies.
Yep.
Now, occasionally, you can see that the gray line goes through one of those bands. That's where we have a loss, and we have to write a check. That's what insurance business. That's the way it works. What's going on in Florida right now? Everybody thought hurricanes were solved, and we found out this winter that hurricanes haven't been resolved, and the insurance companies took a bath. And now, what are they doing? They're raising premiums, they're raising deductibles, and you watch, they're going to make money hand over fist. So that's kind of the way the insurance business works. And you see, I mentioned earlier that we've got this auto recalibration process to stay in step with the market. So you can see the average distance that the calls are above the index, 3.42%. It's on the right-hand side of page 31, and the puts are always a little further below the index, at about 4.3. But when you get into the more volatile markets, you see how those bands expand? That's because if the markets are making bigger moves and expected to be more volatile, and you hold that 80% factor constant, you still want to sell insurance policies that have that fixed underwriting standard, 80%. You've got to sell them further away from the current level of the index. And for us, for you, that's a great thing because you look at, for example, for some reason, I guess to fool you, we didn't put the dates on here. It says it's jumped January of 90 through December of 17, but there's no horizontal axis. But if you look at where those bands widened out in the financial crisis, at the beginning of 2008, we're selling puts and calls that are 3 to 4% away from index. But then the market starts going down, volatility starts going up. So our process says you're going to collect bigger premiums and you need to sell policies with bigger deductibles. And so by the fall of 2008, we're selling downside protection to nervous investors that's 10% or 12% below the index. Very large deductible. Mm-hmm. So the market can drop, at least that far and a little bit more before we have a loss. So we aren't making any, we have no predicting skill.
But this is exactly what you want in this risk diversifying portfolio. You want when the crisis comes, you're going to collect more premium, it's going to be further out of the money, It's going to do exactly what you want it to do.
Yeah, that's why we get such predictable outcomes, is because we aren't, you know, injecting our biases. You know, it's just hard to be, you know, making Yogi Berra. You know, he said it's just it's hard to make predictions about the future. I would tweak it a little bit and say we're really good at making predictions. It's just we're not good at making accurate ones. So we don't do it with, you know, we're not going to do it with your money. So
the interesting thing about this graph is, it looks a lot like my EKG the day I tried day trading. I thought I could do that.
Yeah, it's hard to do. Page 16, why do we do this? You all heard about Willie Sutton. When they asked him why he robbed banks, he said that's where they keep the money. This is our Willie Sutton chart. I'll kind of walk you through it quickly. So each calendar year back to 1990, the blue bars represent the profits from the options. You know, I described how we select these options, the 80% probability. The blue bars are the profits each year from selling the options, expressed in a percent. And the first thing you see if you focus on them is 27 out of 28 years you made money. Now, this is not about hitting home runs. You know, insurance business is more about persistency than hitting home runs. But 27 out of 28 years, that's pretty good. The gray bars are the collateral return, the treasury bill return. And you'll notice if you look at the right-hand side, there's not much in the way of gray bars. Finally, in the last one, we're starting to get some interest on that collateral again. And I said it's up to a little over 2% now. So all we've had the last few years is just the blue bars. The black dots are the total return. So generally, they're kind of just right at the top of those bars, except for 1991, since the options were a little bit of a loser. If this is my Willie Sutton chart, then if you look at 2010, 2011, there's a little black dot below the line. That would be our Sarah Palin dot, I guess. It went rogue. That dot means nothing. unless somebody got it out of your book, it's still in mine, but it went rogue. It means nothing. So you can cross that out. I'm not sure how it got there.
What happened in 91?
So in 1991, S&P was up around 15 or 16%. That's a nice thing. You're making a lot of money on your growth assets, right? And we lost some money on the options. We make something on the collateral. In 1991, the S&P was up 11% in December. And so you can imagine that, you know, if we've sold lottery tickets on the stock market to speculators and it was up 11% in 1 month, they cashed in on that. Somebody got lucky and we got unlucky, you know. So it was all in December last month of the year.
And that's a great example of when you should expect this performance not to be good. And that would be in very strong up markets. January of this year was a tough year, a month for us, because equity markets were straight up. But you would expect your growth portfolio is doing great. And that's the diversification, right? But I want to be fully clear on when this is not going to do well, and that's mainly in those sharp up markets.
Yeah, that's the worst environment for you. You know, if we saw that on page 31, that range of indifference, mm-hmm. when we blow through either side, mm-hmm. that's where we have losses on the options. You know, we want it to stay within that range, and so if you get dramatic moves in either direction, then that's creating some losses on either the calls or the puts, and so.
Like last month, we had that big correction. I mean, it came back up, but how did that? How would that impacted our program?
So, in January, big rally. We would have lost around 3% on the options in the mandate we've described here. Your growth assets would have been up, you know, 6 or 7%, probably something like that. In February, the market then collapsed, and in the first week or so, we would have been down 4% on the options. That has now subsequently, through this, you know, this recalibration process, volatility went up, option premiums went up because of VIX index increase. That causes us to collect bigger premiums, sell wider strikes, and month to date we're about break even on the options. So what you'll tend to see in the sharp downdraft is some initial pain that can be kind of intense, and then things start to recalibrate. It's the hurricanes blow through, insurance gets repriced, and the big opportunity set comes after the hurricanes. But if you're doing dumb things, and you don't, you know, you're using leverage, you maybe don't survive the hurricane, so you don't get to come out the other side when pricing is more attractive.
So the VIX plays a big part into it?
Absolutely. Well, the VIX, that's an interesting question. So VIX is an interesting thing to us. Only in that it's a way to describe the current level of volatility compared to historical norms. Other than that, it doesn't affect us at all. We don't trade VIX options. We don't trade VIX futures. And you may have seen there's been some bad press about, you know, things that are going on in VIX, and I suspect there's some truth to that. It doesn't affect us. All we use VIX for is a way to describe is volatility high now or low relative to history. And it's a useful way to look at the relative valuation of the options. But other than that, it doesn't matter to us at all.
What about politics, like a, you know, North Korea nuclear thing? How does that affect what you're thinking out there? Or the volatility is going to get?
The market, you know, the market reacted quickly to the downside, and then within like a half a day was heading back higher. So okay. It really had de minimis impact.
So to be clear, Jay, on the VIX comment, then VIX is not an input into any of your models, correct?
That's correct. All VIX does is it looks at puts and calls for 30-day options, which are, you know, very close to what we use. We use 28-day options. It looks at what the actual or the implied volatility is in all those options. So it's like a composite. It's just measuring a composite, you know, a statistic. So it's measuring kind of the size of how big premiums are. So it is interesting and useful for us for describing, you know, volatility regimes, but it doesn't directly impact anything we do.
So is it market driven, just whatever people are willing to pay, kind of thing?
Absolutely. It's specifically looking at it looks at trades all day long and puts and calls with 30-day lifetimes in the options, and it looks at one little metric within the pricing formula, implied volatility, and then it rolls it all up through a formula into, right now it's at about 19. 3 weeks ago it was around 10. So if VIX is at 19, it tells you options as a group are being priced with the expectation that the S&P will have an annualized volatility of about 19% over the next 1 month. That's all it does. So I think we're probably running a little short on time, so I'll maybe try and hit a couple of additional pages. It's important, to have been mentioned, you got to know what to expect out of this thing. So page 17, in different environments, what can you expect? Maybe if you start with the column that says puts. So when we sell put options to nervous investors, that's, from our perspective, that's a bullish thing. We're hoping the market doesn't go down, then they aren't going to need their insurance, and we get to keep the premium. So for selling puts, the best environment for us to retain profits is a strong bull market, a modest bull market, or even a flat market. You know, if somebody who's nervous bought a put from us, but it doesn't kick in until the market falls 4 or 5%, you know, the market can fall close to that before we're hurt at all. So those are the best markets for us as a put seller. If the market takes a huge dive, that's where you know, which happened early February, we get some pain from those insurance policies all of a sudden had value, and then we have to start earning our way back, which, you know, we've already started to do this month. So strong bear market is the worst for the puts. Well, if you slide over to the calls, you know, these are opposite exposures. Selling a call option is essentially a bearish bet. It's just the opposite of the put. And so flat markets are good for that. Modest bear markets and strong bear markets. If we're selling upside lottery tickets to speculators and the market stays flat or goes down, they don't have a claim against us, so we get to keep the premium. So you gotta roll these all together. Look at the box on the right hand side. The best environment for us, modest bull, it's kind of the middle three, modest bull, flat, modest bear. That's where we tend to stay nicely within those blue lines, and within that range of indifference, and very few of the puts and calls or the policies end up with claims on them. And of course, that's what we want.
Without getting too deep in the weeds, could you just, is this done through an algorithm, or is there actually someone at the switch at some point? Is there?
Yeah,
it's kind of like likening it to a car. I'm okay with a car, I guess, that's autonomous as long as there's a driver sitting there.
I know.
So how autonomous is this system?
It's rules based, but it's not an algorithm. So it's not like an auto trader. There are 4.5 of us on the investment team that are full time, you know, 110%. There have to be at least two of us that look at every time we make a transaction. There have to be at least two people that looks at it, because one PM or one trader or PM is going to put the order in. Another one has to approve it before it can be released. And so we all know exactly what the rules are, and we don't have to make any judgments on that. The 80% factor is the key thing we have to know, is which put and which call has an 80% probability of expiring without claims, and we can pull that up. I mean, you can actually pull it up on a Fidelity or Schwab, any kind of option pricing screen, but we use, of course, Bloomberg and Thomson Reuters and you know those vendors, but it's easy to pull it up, and so it's not an algo that just does things. It has oversight. What we don't do, though, is we don't bet against it. You know, we're not going to say, well, we're a little bearish, so let's maybe sell more calls and fewer puts. That's not our game. And again, that's why the results are very predictable. We don't make those bets. Yes, sir?
Jay, staying with puts for just a moment and the beginning of this month. If you have you have an extended period on the option, you're the buyer of the option, so you're holding it.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the market has a couple of thousand point drop days. And now the value of that put has suddenly gotten fairly high.
Yes.
Okay, if you cash it in at that point, and let's say you're 2 weeks into your holding period, you've made a fair amount of money, but you think maybe it's going to continue to go down.
Mm-hmm.
So you wait, and boom, we're now at the end of the month, and a good part of your gain has disappeared. How does that fit into how this works? Do most people hold the option throughout its entire period to the last day that it's effective and then sell it? Or yeah. If it has
so
again,
here's the nice thing about that from our perspective. These options are European style, which means they can only be exercised at the very end. They can't, you know, come and do something goofy to us.
So hypothetically, you may have lost a lot of money. I mean,
we have bad marks during the month, and then the market may reverse and go, that's what it did in early February. It dropped into the 7th or 8th, and we had puts that looked, you know, really nasty. And then the market reversed. You know, and a couple of those expired, but we break them up into lots of little pieces. We don't want all the exposure to one date, because that may be a really bad day. But the market reversed, and those claims disappeared.
I like it. Good.
So they're European style. Yeah, they can only be exercised at the very, at expiration.
Okay.
So what would be the optimal time frame to look at to measure success and look at performance? Because obviously you just talked about what would have happened in January and February,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which indicates that maybe shorter term performance isn't going to be as meaningful for us. So as you know, as on the trustee side, what should they be looking
sure.
for? Is that a year? Is that 3 years?
Yeah, I think a year to three. If you flash forward to page 19, we show rolling 3-year returns. And here we're showing the gray again is the rolling 3-year treasury or the underlying collateral that you would post. The rolling 3-year, or the blue is the rolling 3-year profits from the options. And so you can kind of add the two together to get to the total return. So, you know, I certainly think rolling three, if you look at rolling 1-year returns, historically we've never seen that go, you know, more than maybe a percent or two in the red. On a rolling 1-year basis, but you see the black line here. You know the nature of insurance selling. The black line are the drawdowns. So this is just cumulative drawdown, not like a rolling 1 or rolling 3. So in other words, from any peak valuation or of your portfolio, how much pain you know came when we had the setbacks, and you can see, you know, 5% back in 1991 over a few you know 2 or 3 month period, maybe around 7% in 1998. Here we were nice enough to put the labels on. That's so helpful. Almost 10% in the financial crisis. Now those are month end numbers. We'll tell you that you know the interim pain. I told you in February we were down about 4%, and now we're back to even. In 2008 we modeled out the daily moves because we hadn't launched until 2011. The worst point, that was down about 18 or 19% when the market was down about 34%. That chart is actually on page 30 in your book. Full disclosure, this is not free money. You know, there is risk involved. The top chart on page 30 shows the 2-month period, September 1st through October of 2008,
And the dotted teal line is the defensive equity option overlay. You can see by month end it was down about 9.25% when the S&P was down 24.2, and at the worst point down about 19 versus down about 33. But you know, that's obviously nothing says we can't have another period like that. But they do tend to work themselves out, because if have you ever seen an insurance company's checkbook? It's not anything like ours. You know, our checkbooks have like 23 checks and two or three deposit slips. Theirs have like 23 deposit slips and two or three checks. You know, they don't like to write checks. They like to deposit checks. So insurance tends to get repriced pretty quickly, and that's what works in our advantage too. So I should hit one last page, 18. That's the long-term numbers. That's what it looks like, the blue line. You know, it's a pretty smooth ride. Green line is the S&P 500. You can see the statistics, annualized return, net of fees, 9.34, going back almost 30 years. So very close to equity return. The stock market's given you 9.8 over that period. But the stock market's done it with 14% volatility. This strategy at about 4%. So, you know, again, it's these options are opposite. And they have high likelihood of expiring without any claims, and that's what happens to most of them. So they don't create a whole lot of volatility. And people pay up for insurance, because they don't, you know, none of us send a check. When we send a check to State Farm, it's only so we can sleep better at night. And the mortgage company requires it too, right? It's not to make money. You know, you don't make money sending money to insurance companies. They're the ones that make the money. So that's what we want to do, is let's act as the insurance company.
To wrap it up, and really just to hit on your core goals, right? We talked about correlation, low correlation to the growth assets. I know there was, you probably got in your memo, some correlation to all your other assets and what have you. We just looked at it going back through since the last 10 years in 1990 on page 20, but very low correlation to growth assets. And I think low correlation to the other managers you're expecting to put in this risk diversifying portfolio.
Yeah, the blue boxes are the correlation between this strategy and your growth assets. The ones on the right hand side with the gray, that's the correlation amongst your growth assets. So low numbers are better than high numbers in that analysis.
We also talked about liquidity. These are all exchange traded. We don't really need them. We don't need to trade out of them. They'll expire. A quarter of the portfolio will expire every week. It's very liquid. It's extremely, extremely liquid to get out of. The other beautiful thing about this is that tied into the service you currently have with Parametric, you can really do some nice things with putting money into things that you want to get into during a crisis period. Because of the nature of the overlay program, and we've done this with public fund clients, when they want to rebalance, we have a lot of switches to move around. So you can get into something that you want. You can have capital and put that capital to work in a place that you want to put it to work. If there's an opportunity, if there's a fat pitch, and then we can maintain our positions the way that you have them with the program, because you're running it in a very conservative manner. So that's a staff kind of a lot of nuances, but we have done that during financial crisis with other products and clients that use our overlay program. The last thing is the return during stress periods. So I know Jay mentioned this a little bit before. You can see a lot of different events here: Fed tightening, long-term capital, dot-com crisis, global financial crisis, flash crash, sovereign debt crisis. The blue box is the your defensive equity program. You can see very nice returns in these volatile bad markets. The time when the returns are not positive, you'll see our short time periods, 2-month time periods, long-term capital, that's a 2-month period. Flash crash, that's a 2-month period. It's not going to be down as much as the S&P, but it will be down a little bit and will recover nicely afterwards. But we wanted to show that for full disclosure. Fee schedule, page 23. I mentioned kind of what we did here. If like a stock client that came to us and asked us to do what you're doing, about 70 basis points. When we filled out the RFI, we knew you were a client that used us already. We knew this was going to be a large allocation. We discounted it down to 50 basis points. From there, staff has chipped away, got it down to 42, which is basically the lowest we've gone anywhere. and with a further decrease at 39 basis points if you go above $200 million. We've also put a discount on the existing service you have with us, so consider that a $14,000 to $16,000 benefit annually on doing that. So thanks, Tim, for killing our pricing on there. Last page before we get to the appendix, the potential risks. Some of these risks we have to put in here because of compliance. Some of them are actually, we think, true risks. We have kind of how Parametric mitigates these risks. But I would really, again, a lot of them I don't think are really tangible for this particular product, but I would point to the opportunity risk as really kind of something that you should think about. I don't think it's something that really is going to affect you, because you're saying, I don't want to be in growth assets, I want to be in something that's different. But if you see the equity markets churn up a lot, this is not going to perform as well, and you'll feel the opportunity cost of being in something like this. But that's why you have a diversified portfolio. Diversification always, in hindsight, does not look great, because you're in some things that don't do well at times. But there is an opportunity risk of being in something like this as opposed to growth assets.
It's a functionally based allocation, though. I mean, in that sense, it's not about opportunity cost, because this is performing a function, and I think everybody appreciates that, at least I think we all do.
Perfect.
Other questions? I know we covered a lot of ground.
Can you see the pages? I think you have expected returns, so 100 million static allocation.
Oh, yes. Page 28. Yeah, so this is using the live track record for option only mandates, which started back in September of 2011. But in that particular case, it's a foundation out of New York that funded early on in the options only. And the construct that they use is, if they put up $50 million in cash, in T-bills, we sell $25 million in calls and $25 million in puts. I think I described this one a little bit earlier. So in the most draconian environment, if the market went to zero, they would only, on a $50 million invested base, they would lose $25 million, because they have no beta also in their base portfolio, but they're not fully deploying the value of the treasury. So we took that live track record, which is over 6 years now, and then just double the numbers. That's because we'd have the same options for you. We just have twice the exposure. We have, instead of 25 million calls, 25 million puts, we have 50 million calls, 50 million puts. No leverage, just fully deploying your cash allocation. So those are live numbers, but with just ramping the dials up. All of these different accounts that we have clients that run zero beta in the base, 0.3 in the base, 0.5 beta in the base, 0.75 in the base, and some that go 100% equity and just sell calls. But the options are all the same. In fact, we block all the options together onto one order. It's just the asset mix that changes. The options are all the same.
So if you started this program in September of 2011, you should have expect 4.06 annual return, net of all fees. But what that doesn't include is the T-bill return, because this does not include the T-bill return. So it would be a little bit more, because you'd have some level of T-bill return. It hasn't been great, but
it wouldn't have been much different, because the rates have been zero for that period. But that's all getting better now. So
you can see the 3 year, 1 year, quarter hasn't been so great. Since September 2011, it's been about 4.06 net.
Ed, was there another page that you had a question?
The T-bills are used mainly for ballast or for able to move money in and out of?
Yeah, so the real purpose is so that when we have a claim, we don't want to have a margin call. You don't like margin calls. We don't like margin calls. So if we sell one of these policies that goes in the money or has value, has a claim, we need to be able to generate some cash to pay it off.
Okay.
So if when that happens, if we don't have enough just residual cash sitting there, we can sell a few T-bills to generate the cash. So that's really the only purpose there. So you don't get any margin calls.
Okay.
And you aren't running any leverage. I think that's probably important.
What agency of the government oversees this?
Well, CFTC, the
SEC.
SEC. We NFA. Get audited by everybody. NFA, the National Futures Association, SEC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
CFTC.
Although we don't use any futures, we only use options. Yeah. DOL, you know, because we're a QPAM and all, you know, all that stuff.
Eaton Vance is the ultimate parent too of Parametric, so there's some deep pockets there.
Okay. Yeah, I was looking over the disclosure stuff.
Yeah. And a lot of these net of fees too are the higher 50 basis points, not the 42 which you've been able to negotiate. So, just want to make sure you're clear. Should be better than what we're showing, based on your negotiated fee schedule.
Anything else for our guests?
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. You were generous with it.
Yeah.
Thanks for your patience.
Of course.
Oh, we're just going back to snow. I was hoping I'd miss my flight, actually.
So with our traffic, you have a shot, right? Higher prices, higher traffic. There's still time to miss your flight.
Great. Item 6, consider and take possible action.
I'll move the recommendation.
Second.
Moved and seconded.
A question on page 23, if you could go. I don't want to be overly cute here, but...
On their handout you have?
Yeah, I'm sorry, on their handout.
Yeah.
Do we have to approve, and I'm not being cute here, but sometimes people really get hung up on the words. It says above $200 million. If the resolution is for $200 million, in order for us to pick up another 2 basis points, do we have to approve $200 million and $1? I mean, I'm serious, because I don't want to miss the 2 basis points if that's what we need to do.
I mean, that's... So on page 23, you're taking a look at the first $200 million being 42 basis points.
I got it. I'm looking at 39. It says above 200 million.
He's saying, does it all drop to 39?
Does it probably? No,
it doesn't. No.
Right.
The
marginal rate.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm looking for it.
All right. And you know, in moving the recommendation, I want to also say I thought our guests let the cat out of the bag, but it sounds like you did a very nice job negotiating the fees. So, thank you.
We had a long dialogue about where we thought value was at in this fund.
Okay. Yeah. Very well done.
Yeah. Any other discussion?
All right. Then I withdraw my question.
Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstention? Motion passes. Great. And item